Hi, I'm Brian.
I'm Kyle.
And I'm Ruthie.
And we host
The Walking Dead
and Fear the Walking Dead.
Talk Through,
a Golden Spiral Media podcast dedicated to
The Walking Dead
and Fear the Walking Dead
TV shows on AMC. Each episode, we break down what happened, what we think will happen, and talk through our listener feedback.
Because our listeners are very important to us. Isn't that right, Kyle?
Yes, indeed.
Subscribe to us in Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.
Or visit us on our website, walkingdeadtalkthrough.com.
And join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/walkingdeadgsm.
See you soon, survivors. And welcome to another fine episode of the Star Trek Discovery Podcast. I'm Brian.
And I'm Adam.
And tonight, well, it's tonight for us. We are here to discuss Season 1, Episode 8, titled...
Here we go.
Si Vis Pecum Parabellum.
Ooh, you did that pretty well.
Well, hopefully I did. Written by... She is a staff writer on the show, maybe story editor. I don't remember. I think she just has the position of staff writer, but she also is the liaison between the other properties like comic books and novels. Kirsten Beyer, former Star Trek Voyager novelist, directed by John S. Scott. So let's open a shipwide announcement. Well, normally we would have errata. I don't think we have any errata this episode, but if we did, I'd put it here. But if I forget something, then I say
incorrect
in advance. The English translation for the episode title is, if you want peace, prepare for war. First in news, and this is to toot our own horn a little bit, as of Friday, we found out that we have been made the exclusive Star Trek Discovery podcast featured in the TV Time app. So... that's pretty darn cool. And they had a nice little article, which we have linked to in the Facebook group that basically tells about it. And they said some really nice things about us. So to the TV Time people, thank you so much for featuring us. We hope not to let you down.
Yeah, very much appreciated. Thank you so much.
Yeah. And I also want to thank our buddy and fellow GSM podcast host, Tro Heinrichs. I know that he was involved in this and getting us in front of them. So thank you, Troy, for, you know, helping to set this up. I don't know how much of it was you and how much of it was them, but regardless, thank you so much. And so we'll have to see how many of our downloads come from them. I'm curious, but even if it's a few, it's a great honor. So especially since they only feature one podcast per show. So.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So this isn't like, you know, this is an exclusive thing. So anyway, I was able to pull a few things from, on Sunday, several of the cast of Star Trek Discovery were in London on a publicity tour, going through Europe, and as well as co-showrunner Aaron Harberts was there. And he gave a little bit of an update on the progress of this season. So right now they are locking down the finale. I guess that probably means that they're, you know, dealing with the editing and the special effects and stuff like that. I believe the shooting's done. And that they are confirming that each season of the show will be treated as a novel, with this being the war novel about the Klingons wrapping up at the end of the first season. So supposedly next season will not deal with the war. So that'll be interesting.
Yeah, I got the impression, especially from some of the dialogue in this very episode, that the war would be a more of a protracted thing. To wrap it up in six episodes seems like doesn't seem like much of a war.
Well, we'll see what exactly that means. You know, maybe that's taken out of context a little bit. I don't know. Maybe it's just like the first part of the war or something. He continues. He said work on developing season two will begin in 2 weeks. So I believe that's, you know, the producers and the writers, you know, sitting down and trying to work out the stories and the whole arc for the season. And he did say that the team is going to look at what has worked and hasn't worked with the first season as they thrash out the themes that they want to bring to the fore for season two. So that's good. I think that's always good for them to try to analyze what has worked, because there have been some things that have really worked and some things that, you know, haven't quite as worked as well.
Yeah, it's tough to remember, especially with the budget on this show, that they really are finding their way episode by episode, because it is just the first season. And if any previous series are anything to go by, it's going to take them maybe into next season and maybe even the one beyond until they really find out what the true character of the show is.
Yeah, and it's rare for, you know, any TV show to really hit the ground on all cylinders in the first season. It does happen. There have been a few, but, you know, some of those shows, they never quite, you know, recapture that glory that they had in the first season. And while others, you know, take several seasons, and that's been the way that most of the Star Trek series have gone. It's taken, you know, 2-3 years before the show really gels. And, you know, I would expect nothing less from this one.
Yeah, I would agree.
Sonequa Martin-Green I've heard her say this before, but she's done, I hear this a lot, headcanon. Do they have headcanon in Star Wars?
I assume they must. I mean, the writers can only invent so much and the actor has to fill in the rest.
Yeah, because I hear a lot of, like, a lot of other Star Trek podcasts where they talk about their own headcanon. And it's just like, whatever. It's canon, and it's your ability to interpret it. But anyway, she has worked out that her character is named Michael after her biological father, and that in the future, gender names are more fluid. Whereas supposedly, Harberts revealed that Michael Burnham was named for the Archangel Michael, but he prefers Sonequa's version.
That's an interesting writing inspiration there. I wonder if the shape of the character and her arc in the series is any way influenced by that inspiration.
A few other things. This one we'll probably talk about, but the rest of them I just want to go quickly through. He says that the team is aware of the redesign of the Klingons has been polarizing, quote unquote, with the fans. I would say that's a slight understatement, not exaggeration. There's something I can use to say.
Incorrect.
Slight understatement, to say the least. But defended the decision, saying it was part of co-creator and former showrunners former showrunner Brian Fuller's original vision to go deeper into Klingon culture. Well, to that I say, okay, you can go deeper into Klingon culture without changing the look of the Klingons. To me, why do you have to make them bald?
Yeah.
I just don't get. You can go deeper in the Klingon culture without changing the entire look of the Klingons. And you know, screwing around with their noses, and because that, I don't get what they did with their noses. But it's more than that. It's Klingons have had long, luxurious hair, and now they don't have any hair. So we've talked
not about even this. Body hair. Did you see the corpse at the end of this episode? That thing was hairless.
Yeah. Completely.
Maybe this is, you know, they say they got these different strains and diseases running through the various houses of Klingon, and that explains the discrepancies by, at least that's how Worf explained it to us. Maybe this particular strain of Klingons has alopecia.
I don't know. They enjoyed working with director Jonathan Frakes, who gave tips on doing the bridge shake effect, something that he and TNG cast members mastered after seven seasons. Yes, of course they did.
Yeah.
That was a big part of the special effects budget.
Yeah, getting everybody to lurch in unison.
Yep. A couple little things again. Sinequa, Martin Green, and James Frayne trained separately for their fight in Lethe, which I thought was interesting. And Doug Jones is an angel to work with and a big hugger. Isn't that nice?
It is nice, actually. He seems like the sort of guy you'd, Saru at least, seems like the sort of guy you'd kind of want to get a hug from.
Mm. All right. Well, it is now time to discuss our thoughts and feelings about this episode. So, Adam, I'm going to let you start off. What did you think of that Latin episode title?
Boy, I have no idea how to pronounce it, so that's why I give you credit for even coming up with that.
Si vis pacem parabellum.
Is pacem not pacem?
Maybe pacem, maybe pacem. I don't know. I would love to hear a pronunciation of it. I will say it both ways. Si vis pacem parabellum.
Yeah, Latin is apparently a dead language, and yet people keep using it.
Yep.
But I have to say that this is maybe my favorite episode thus far for being the best blend of classic episodic Trek format and serialized Discovery Trek format. So I gave it 9.25 dead admirals.
What?
Dead?
Question mark?
Yes. Question mark. Well, this should be a good episode because I don't agree. So this will spark debate. I did not like this episode very much. So I'm going to give it 7. And that's being generous, I think. Because there was a lot of stuff that I liked. But I'll get into the stuff that I didn't like.
Okay.
7. Funky alien fingernails.
Yeah, there were a lot of hand close-ups in this one, I noticed.
Yeah. And I don't know what's going on with Saru's fingernails, but they are nasty looking. They may not be actually nasty looking, but they certainly looked it. They were all black and weirdly shaped, and I couldn't help but notice them. But we got some ratings from some of our listeners who kind of agreed with me more than they did you. I'll give the first one. Mari said, I give this episode 8 crystal trees out of 10, which I guess isn't a bad one.
Yeah, that's pretty solid. However, our buddy Mark Decote says 6 out of 10 freshly roasted trout.
And we got feedback from another person from Cleveland. I had to look it up to make sure that it wasn't the same guy, but we got feedback last week from Mike from Cleveland, and this time we got feedback from Rick from Cleveland. He said, I would rank this episode 7 speedster Sarus out of 10.
I like the speedster Saru part. Fred from the Netherlands says, 7 landing party equipment failing earplugs.
Yeah.
That would seem to be a very simple solution to Saru's problem, wouldn't it?
Yeah, especially, you know, I mean, unless somehow Saru's ears couldn't stand earplugs or something, but he should have had earplugs.
Especially knowing the way the planet operated when they went down there, you'd assume that they had, you know, planned for these contingencies.
All right, it is time for our yeses and nos, so here we start with the yeses.
Yes!
And it's to us, because we did get some yeses from Fred and Mark, but they are contained in their voicemails, so we'll get to them later in the voicemail section. So, what's your first yes?
I've got to go with the opening battle. I was really looking forward to seeing more space battles fully fleshed out, and this one did not disappoint at all. I like the effects, I like the pacing, I like the strategy. It was great to see Lorca in his element being a battlefield general, and the ship held up well. I think the crew is adapting to the new lifestyle of war. What about you, Brian?
Well, I will say
yes,
because that I have to absolutely completely agree with you. That was going to be my big yes. In fact, to me, that the episode kind of went downhill from there. Because it really started strong, but it after the battle, it wasn't quite as strong. My first thing, I don't think that this is necessarily positive, but I will say that thank God this wasn't the mid-season finale, because I don't think this would have been a good episode to end with. I think, you know, originally, you know, when they extended it, I thought it was just number crunchers that were, you know, thinking that they could extend memberships an extra week. But I got to say that I don't think that this would have been a good episode, at least the episode that we saw, and I'm saying it that way because I'll get to that later in my nose. This, as seen, this episode would not have been a good mid-season finale to me. There was just too much open-ended and not enough tension there to end on, oh, the Klingons are coming. You know, it should have ended in battle or, you know, some big reveal. And I don't think that it ended on a big reveal. So,
yeah, I would agree with that. I think leaving the fallout from Discovery versus the Death Ship or whatever you want to call it, that's a much better place to leave it for the mid-season finale than it is to just leave the setup for that encounter.
Yeah. Do you have any more yeses?
You know, that was the weird thing. I loved this episode, but the number of things that stood out, really, I had a hard time coming up with them this week. So I thought it was kind of even throughout, I guess, because there weren't too many overall high points for me. I'm going to have to give a second yes to Doug Jones' performance as Saru. I think he did a phenomenal job. Upon second watching, I thought you could actually visually tell the difference of when he was under the sway of the Pavo. He usually, his makeup has this way. I mean, he looks very alien.
Yeah.
And yet he never looks imposing or dangerous in most cases, but I don't know if it was the way it was shot or just the way he was performing through the makeup, but he truly looked alien and dangerous once he had decided to stay on the planet.
Yeah. I thought he was under alien influence, but apparently not. He was willfully doing mutiny. Essentially, he was being a mutineer, much like Burnham. So I wonder if that's going to help him understand a little bit better Burnham. He was doing mutiny. He was going against orders. That's mutiny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really interesting turnabout that he gets some experience in her actions for a change. That might be sort of a bridge for those two to grow closer.
All right. Well, it is now time for the nose.
No!
And like I said, in the yes section, we got some nose from Fred from the Netherlands and Mark Decote in their voicemails. So we'll get to them in a minute or two. But what is your nose? Do you just have the one no?
Yeah, that's my only main gripe. But it's a big one. That's almost a discussion point. We can get into this now or we can save it for the open discussion later if you want.
No, let's go into it.
All right, let's get right into it then. I am not a fan of Ash and Burnham getting together. I think the show is too new and the character arcs of both characters are too new to have to resort to a relationship already. I think I'm not looking for that yet in this show. I don't care about the characters enough to see where their personal lives go and how they intertwine.
Hmm. Okay. That's not what I thought you were going to say. Because I didn't think where they were hooking up was very appropriate.
Also that.
Yeah. But I do see your point, because I think that they could do some work to flush out the Burnham character a little bit. And yeah, because this is the weird thing that I have with her. I noticed this in the notes, in your notes. So I'm kind of stealing from what you said, but, you know, her character, like, she's doing a great job playing that character, but the way that they've designed the character, not terribly interesting, you know. It's like they didn't give her enough personality. And I think that this is like a problem dealing with Vulcans in general. You know, it's like, because when they've had Vulcans that, like, Spock was a little different because he was half human and, you know, struggled with it and all of that stuff. And he could play off Bones and all of that. But in this show, she's like a Vulcan. She's Vulcan-ish, I guess you could say. But her behavior sometimes it just comes off as weird, because it's not always obvious that she's a Vulcan, you know, like born and raised on Vulcan. You know what I
yeah.
mean?
Yeah. She seems to go back and forth between human and Vulcan. And this is a lot of the problem. I've actually been binging Enterprise lately. And I think this is the problem with T'Pol as well. It's so hard to play a Vulcan and not have it come off as deadpan rather than an emotionless trait of the character.
Yeah.
You know, so like she, especially in Burnham's case, sometimes she'll be completely normal and human and a little uncomfortable because she doesn't have the normal social upbringing that humans do. But she'll seem entirely human and then shift into this strange deadpan Vulcan kind of mode. And it's just jarring and it's not compelling. It's just disinteresting.
Yeah, I agree.
So when you get a charisma magnet like Ash, I mean, he seems to be the life of the party. Literally, he's, you know, raising toasts and everything in the last episode. And for him to take such an interest in her, it doesn't seem very plausible, unless it's a case of total opposites attract. But I would imagine she would not be his type.
I hadn't thought of that, but now that you say it, I could kind of see what you're saying. It makes sense that what is it about her that makes him intrigued, other than, you know, that he fought her in battle when he was still Valk, which we'll find out one way or the other. I hope that mystery will be kind of uncovered next episode, because I think the internet wants to know, and so do I. All right, well, I have two no's down here, and they're related. So I'll go with the small one, and it was part of my yeses last week. The fact that there was no cold open. Why is this a problem this time when it wasn't, when it was a good thing last time? Well, I was trying really hard to figure out what was it that I had a problem with in this episode. And I really had a hard time struggling, you know, trying to figure it out. And I finally figured it out. It's far too short. This episode, I don't know. It's like someone went into it. I don't think it was poorly written. In fact, I think it was well written. The special effects are really good in it. The performances are really good in it. The problem is it was 41 minutes and 22 seconds with the intro, you know, and the song and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. The previously on, which was 57 seconds, and, you know, the next on and the credits at the end. So there was not even 40 minutes of actual show. Like, it was something like 38 minutes or maybe 39 minutes tops. There wasn't enough there. And based on what we saw between what was going on the planet and, to a lesser extent, I would say, but still, what was going on the Klingon ship, there were two episodes there in potential. Like, certainly there should have been a much longer episode. It was almost like they cut at least 10 minutes out of the episode for some godforsaken reason that I can't figure out. It was like some editor just went crazy on there and just started cutting like crap until certain parts of the story didn't make any sense anymore. Like, how is it that Saru goes out there and he, you know, gets basically trying to sleep and they connect with him and he comes out and he's like smashing communicators, you know, the next morning? It's just like, why didn't we see what happened there? There had to have been more story there. The same thing I could say on the Klingon ship. There was a bunch of stuff that I think probably happened between Laurel and Cornwell that we didn't get to see. And there was too much taken out of this episode, and I don't understand why.
Yeah, I wanted more on the Klingon ship with Laurel and Cornwell, because I was with you. I thought that it felt like there was a lot more story there that was not shown, and especially because of what was left and how fast that all seemed to move as a result, I think it would have had a lot more impact if it had more time to breathe. I didn't realize the episode was so short. They clearly had plenty of runtime to do more if they wanted to.
Oh, yeah. So one thing I thought of is that perhaps we're going to see some of the Klingon story moved forward into the next episode. So to make it a good season finale, they've taken part of that story and they're going to, you know, hook it on to the next story, and which they can do because it's a serialized story. So, you know, that might work, and played together, these two episodes may work out really well, but it's like I say, it just seemed like part of the story was missing. And that's like at the start of it, like you said, the battle was amazing. It wasn't just, you know, good. It was fantastic. Like exactly what I would have hoped. And I just felt like it went downhill from there, and I wasn't expected. I just took me a long time to figure out that's what the problem was. But when I first opened up, you know, the website and, you know, saw that the episode had appeared and I saw it and it had the time on it, it said 41:22. I'm like, that's it? How come it's so short this week? And, you know, then I watched it and I said, but then I didn't realize that was the problem that I had with the episode until I started, you know, I think by the third watch, I figured out that's what it was.
Yeah. Just not enough meat in the bones in this one, huh?
No. So like I say, I might watch next week with this one and it might feel a lot better, but it just by itself, I don't think it worked for me.
Yeah, I hope being mid-season finale, they go a little bit longer with that one. I mean, I don't know what sort of guidelines they have for runtime, but you're right. I mean, 41 minutes, including all the extraneous stuff, for lack of a better term, you know, the recap and the intro theme, that's, you know, it's almost shortchanging in a way. You expect roughly an hour's worth of TV, including commercials, and this is obviously well short of that.
Yeah, and I want to give some credit to one video that I watched today that helped me crystallize my thoughts. And that was Collider on YouTube. They do like a recap of Discovery, and they were talking about much the same things that I was just talking about, that, you know, the show seemed like it had two episodes in it that, you know, could have been two episodes instead of this short episode. And it really, hearing them talk about it really helped me figure out why I was having the reaction that I had. So just want to give credit where credit's due.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Quick side note I wanted to bring up here. Do you think we really need the recap at the beginning of the episode at this point? We're seven shows in. We're almost at the mid-season break. Do you really need a recap of the entire series thus far?
Well, I know from what I've heard, Netflix, they don't get it. I know they don't get what's coming next, and I don't think they get what is coming, or maybe it fast forwards you through it. So,
yeah, I mean, especially with a streaming access show like this, if you're lost watching the episode, you could just go back and watch the other ones.
Very true.
Now, on Space in Canada, that might not be the case. I don't know if they get the recaps there.
I don't know, but I'm sure we'll hear from Mark next week, who will tell us. All right. Well, it is now time for our feedback segment, so I'm going to open hailing frequencies. All right. Well, our first is a voicemail from Mark.
Hey, Adam. Hey, Brian. Mark from Ontario, Canada here. I give this episode 6 out of 10 freshly roasted trout. Now, I really wanted to give this episode a higher rating, but there was just too many moments throughout that I went, what? That's not making sense. Or I was questioning things, and it really took me out of it. Normally, I love these first contact type episodes, but in this case, as I said, there was just too many moments in the episode that left me scratching my head. Now, that opening battle sequence was spectacular. I really liked that. But what was the point of that whole sequence? Was it just there to show us that the war is still going on? Or was that entire battle sequence just to show us that there's something wrong with Stamos, which we already knew? So even though it was really interesting and fun to watch, there really wasn't much of a point to it. Although Stamos calling Tilly captain, could that be another reference to the Mirror Universe? And one question I had about all of this is when Stamos tells Tilly that he's putting his doctor friend there in a compromising position, it led me to believe that nobody outside of Discovery actually knows that Stamos is the one running the spore drive. Does everyone at Starfleet still think they're using the tardigrade to control their drive? See, these are some of the things I was questioning just on that opening sequence. Now, one of the plots from this episode was on the planet Parvo. And one of the issues I had with it was that that plot starts off with them walking through the woods because they had to beam down 30 kilometers away due to transmitter interference. And yet, at the end of the episode, Discovery was able to beam them up from directly next to the transmitter. So what changed? The transmitter wasn't causing any interference anymore? And there was no questioning or no reference to that cabin that they stayed in on the planet. If there's no life forms on this planet other than these blue glowy things, why is there some sort of cabin built in the woods to protect and shelter them? Was it built just for them? Now, we did see a little sequence where the Parvo lights read Saru's memories and found out about the war and the Klingons and all that. But what exactly did they do to him? Was he infected some way? Was he under some sort of mind control? Or was it literally just him deciding that, oh, Starfleet wasn't worth it anymore and we're just all going to live down here? He said at the end that it was the first time in his life he didn't feel fear, but was that enough for him to go against his crewmates and Starfleet? And if it was him, is he going to be able to return to duty as the first officer? And if it wasn't just him, if he was compromised somehow, how did they fix him? There was no explanation to any of that. And speaking of Saru, just how strong is he? Burnham shot him twice with the phaser set on stun, and he didn't go down. If his species are considered prey, I'd hate to see the predator that hunts them. Now, the other part of the story was the Klingons. I had a lot of head-scratching moments here. Like, why would the guard leave his post just because he heard the prisoner scream during an interrogation? That didn't make any sense to me. And then when Elril or whatever her name is and the Admiral were escaping and they get caught, and then she just tells Cole that the Admiral escaped, took her blade, and that she stopped her. And he was okay with that. He just turned around and walked away when she said, I'll dispose of the body. Like, he was okay with the fact that this human escaped on her watch. And anyways, again, it just didn't make sense. Not to mention, is the Admiral really dead? Because that was going back and forth, back and forth. Here, Elrel saying she wants to defect because everyone she knows is gone and there's nothing left for her, which I don't know if that was a ploy or a ruse or not. And then she has that fight with the Admiral, and it looks like she kills the Admiral, but did she really kill the Admiral? Then she gets back to her ship, only to find all her crew is dead, and no explanation, like, why is her crew and her people dead? Who killed them and why? And then Cole invites her to be part of his house or to join allegiances with him, and then immediately said that he's going to punish her for her deceit. Again, as I said, so many head-scratching moments in this one. Now, I've shared a lot of things that could be considered my turbo lift down moments in this episode. So now here are a couple of turbo lift up moments. First of all, the character Saru, I have to say that the makeup that they're using, the mask that he has, is very, very well done. Even with all the prosthetics that he has on his face, you can still see the emotions that he's emitting and putting out. So I'm really enjoying that makeup. The battle at the beginning of the episode, even though I said earlier I thought it was kind of pointless, like there was no reason to really show it to us, but it was very, very well choreographed and done. I like that. And finally, we got to see a Klingon and a human fight and the human lose. It's about time we get to see just how good they are. So anyways, those are my thoughts on this episode. I really wish I could have rated it higher, but there was just too many, as I said, head-scratching moments that brought my rating down. Can't wait to see how they're going to end the first half of the season next week. Talk to you then. This is Mark from Ontario, Canada, out.
Well, thanks, Mark. And as usual, great voicemail and showcase winner. I'll just give you a short one there so we can keep going. I wondered this too from something that Mark said. Exactly why is Stamets the only pilot of the Spore Drive at this point? You would think that this is actually taxing them. So why wouldn't they inject tardigrade DNA into, you know, some other volunteers and have multiple pilots so that, you know, you could recover a little bit from piloting the thing? It's obviously taxing on Stamets at this point. So, you know, why is he the only one?
Do they still have tardigrade DNA?
Well, I don't know for sure, but I would think that they wouldn't have, like, used up the entire supply. You would think that they would, like, if they had used up the entire supply, that they couldn't synthesize more from Stamets himself, right?
Yeah, I hope there's some explanation, because you're right. It doesn't make any sense to go out there without a backup. I mean, he's basically part of the engine now, and they carry spares of anything else that they can find. So why wouldn't they have a spare spore navigator, for lack of a better term?
Exactly. Yeah. So to that, when that was the first thing I thought of when, you know, we find out what's going on with Stamets, and what the heck was it when he said, you know, that Tilly was captain? What do you think's going on there with that?
Well, given that the last episode showed that he exists outside of the normal time flow now, I really took it, based on her comment in her introduction, that she said, I'm going to be captain someday. So I think he loses his place in time a little bit when they use the spore drive, and she apparently at some point does make captain, and he was just confused as to which point in the timeline he was at that moment.
All right, so next thing that he brings up is that no reference to the cabin. And yeah, I didn't understand that. Like, okay, is it that the entire planet is alive and is a life form, or are these beings? And, you know, what is with the cabin? Did these beings make the cabin just for them, or what? I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know either, but I was struggling to find an explanation for that. And that's that your explanation is as good as I could come up with. They simply built it to provide for their guests. Otherwise, yeah, it doesn't seem like there's any purpose for the thing. They have no corporeal body, so why would they bother with anything like a tent or a fire or any form of shelter whatsoever? So, yeah, that must have strictly been for the away team's benefit.
You would think so. So, Saru, okay, so I took, he was saying about, you know, there being no explanation for his behavior. Well, I think it's pretty clear that, you know, he was not following orders, and he was on his own simply trying to stay at peace on the planet. I didn't really understand why it was necessary for them to stay with him, though.
Yeah, that one, my only thought was, yes, he can stay on the planet by himself in peace, but he's still enough of himself that he doesn't want to be alone. It seemed like while he could communicate with the beings, I guess, it seems like there's more than one coalescing towards the end around the antenna. It's not true companionship. So he wasn't really turning his back on his crewmates so much as wanting them to share in what he felt.
Yeah.
You know, I liken it to Odo a lot, you know, where he didn't know what it was like to be part of the Great Link. And then once he did, there was that constant pull. So even though he never meant to betray his companions on Deep Space Nine, when he knew what he had been missing all this time, the pull became too strong to ignore at times.
Yeah. Something that Mark mentioned that I had some notes for was the whole prey versus the apex predators. And you think about this for a second. So he can run 80 kilometers an hour, which works out to, it's about 50 miles an hour for you Americans out there. Yes, I can still speak metric. he's about 6'8", supposedly. He can take multiple phaser shots at stun and yet not get completely knocked out. And he can crush communicators in his bare hands. So that's pretty amazing. He can do all that, and yet he's the prey. Okay, so what the heck are these Kelpian apex predators like, and you know, what kind of skills do they have? They must be scary people.
Yeah, that was kind of shocking to find out all that stuff. And can you imagine just what Saru himself would be like if he didn't have, okay, so he was apparently at peace when he was crushing communicators and beating down Burnham. Imagine if he was actually angry like a predator would be. What kind of power would he possess then?
Yeah. Yeah. I can't imagine, though. Okay. Obviously, if they were born to be prey, probably these predators, you know, like a challenge, I imagine. So, but it reminds me of that, remember that Deep Space Nine episode? I think it was called Captive Pursuit.
Yes.
Yeah. Reminds me of that a little bit, because it was a similar thing with, the Ray, I can't remember the name of the race. I remember the character's name was Tosk, and O'Brien, you know, kind of helped him get off the station and, you know, continue the chase between, you know, him and the hunters that were hunting him. But it just reminds me of that. And I really want to see at some point, you know, before the end of the season, if not, then maybe season two, we'll see what these predators are really like. Cause I definitely want to, I'm very, very curious about them.
Yeah. I feel like there's a lot of backstory there that would be interesting to get into, but, They seem to be very intent on moving the story forward without too many detours that really go deep into the side lives of the characters. So I don't know if there'll be time to get to it in this season or not, but if they are planning on moving forward and maybe shifting the focus in season two, that would be a good place to explore that.
Yeah. Well, he mentioned, and he didn't get her name right exactly. I think he called her Elrel. Her name is Lorel. Yeah. Anyway, with Lorel, I don't know. For me, it's really hard to figure out what her true motivations are. It seems like, you know, she's changing direction, you know, every time you see her. So, like, I have to think if the whole, you know, Ash is Valk story, you know, or theory is correct, she's trying to maneuver a way to get onto Discovery so that she can either be with him or activate him or whatever. But it's really hard to figure out, you know, like, was she actually trying to defect, or is this some other ruse that she's trying to do? What do you think?
That's a very good question, and I'm not sure what I believe just yet. Again, a casualty of the length of the show, I wanted to see more, and I just needed more material to be able to come up with a decision. Because the exchange in the hallway when Cole came and found them, and then the battle between Cornwell and Lorel ensued, the dialogue there between the two as the fight was taking place was kind of hard to follow. It seemed almost like the end fight where Cornwell died was almost choreographed and agreed upon, but we never saw them actually plot that out to say, if we're discovered, I'm going to, you know, do this or that. So I wasn't really sure about that either. And the other question I had was, just because she doesn't agree with what Cole is doing, that doesn't mean that she agrees with the Federation, though.
Right.
And she joined the war willingly enough to try to, you know, keep Klingons pure and whatnot. I don't think just because she doesn't like the current leadership of her own regime that she's going to join the other side.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense in that regard. I mean, it makes sense that she doesn't like Cole because, you know, she calls Cole a Patach, which I've heard that one before.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a Patach, but, cause, you know, he has no honor. Really, he's just out there, you know, just out for himself, basically out to try to, get whatever power that he can, which,
yeah.
I wanted to talk about this, so I don't know if I mentioned it yet, but the whole Cole thing.
You haven't brought that up yet.
Okay. I really want to understand what the deal is there. He continually says he's part of the House of Kor. So where the F is Kor? Okay, I gotta know this. Is the Kor that we know, is that the same Kor, or is that, you know, Cole's and Kor's father or something? Like, is this Kor like an old Kor, right? And mm-hmm. Cole is the firstborn or something, and Kor, the other Kor, is the secondborn, which seems kind of stupid for them to do that, but just assuming that's true. Is that what it is? There's an old Kor, and he's, you know, like, too old to be a warrior anymore. And Cole's the guy now, but, you know, he can't say House of Kor right now because, Kor's still alive, which would seem crazy. Seem like Klingons would just kill themselves if they're old. But, yeah. So I want to know, if he's got all this power, why isn't House of Kor? Why is it House of Kor? It doesn't make any sense. And if Kor is even bigger, where the heck is Kor?
I can't even offer an explanation for that one. I usually try to find something, but I agree with you. The war against the Federation is the biggest battle taking place for the Klingon Empire right now. So you would think every warrior, able or not, is rushing to the cause.
Yeah, and to me, like, these are nitpicky things. That's a nitpicky thing. It's not going to dramatically improve the story if Kor suddenly shows up. But it is a nagging question that I've got, and I want an explanation, because those kind of nagging questions, after a while, they become chronic and systemic problems. And, you know, so they could deal with this fairly easily and just explain it.
I think maybe it's a case of something like this happened in one of the Star Wars shows too, where it takes place long after another show that they had on a few years back. And the writers basically said that the reason they didn't really tie anything directly together in the first season was because they wanted to take the time to establish their own story and their own characters before they brought in the legacy characters. So the audience had a chance to connect with the new stuff before they risked overshadowing it with connections to the past. And I think maybe if you brought in Kor right away and tied it too directly to the original series at this point, no one would care about Cole or anything else going on, because they'd be so fascinated by seeing the original series character.
Well, okay. But I mean, they've already brought in some original series characters like Sarek, which, you know, it could, there's nothing story-wise that had to make him Sarek. Like, it could have been any Vulcan, really. Could have been another Vulcan ambassador or another Vulcan, you know, official. It didn't have to be Spock's dad, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and Mudd, you know, it's okay. Mudd, the last episode he was in was good, I think, but to see him, we didn't need to see. It could have been any villain, really. I mean, didn't have to be Mudd. So,
yeah, and that's kind of been my argument the whole time here too, is they didn't have to be the Klingons.
Nope.
You could have invented a whole new race and had the same storyline, but they chose instead to reimagine the Klingons a bit. And that's, getting back to Laurel, I think that might be part of the reason that she might have been genuine in trying to defect, because she does seem to be someone who takes honor seriously and Cole does not. So when she, you know, there's that little exchange between Cornwell and Laurel where they both admit that the other is not what they expected. And I think it's a case of not knowing your enemy. And the more you get to know them, the more you see yourself in them. So there's at least a growing respect that wasn't there before. And she might actually reason out that she's got no allies left in her own cause. Cole has either killed or subverted everyone that she cared about. And now the only people that she feels any sort of a similitude with are the Federation, based on what Cornwell has told her about how they operate. So that might have been a genuine wish to defect, because she may see more of her agenda in what the Federation is doing than in what her own people are doing at this point.
So you think that maybe she now looks at what T'Kuvma was teaching, that he got it all wrong? Do you think?
Well, he was preaching purity and unity. He wasn't preaching seizing power for its own sake.
True. Yeah.
And Cole specifically even says, "Bring me something that will enhance my glory. Not something that will help our cause, not something that will defeat the Federation. Bring me something that will enhance my glory." So he's all in it for himself.
Right. Right. But like T'Kuvma, you know, wanted, he was, you know, teaching purity of the Klingon species, you know. Mm-hmm. He looked at the Federation as, you know, interlopers, ones that, you know, would try to assimilate, try to assimilate Klingons into the Federation and, you know, they would lose their identity. Does she maybe think that was wrong?
She might. She might, because the other thing that Tukavma said was when Georgiou said that they come in peace, he said that was the ultimate lie. And everyone believed him. Maybe with more exposure to the Federation now, Laurel is seeing that maybe it wasn't a lie and their intentions were genuine.
Now, okay, so should we talk about Cornwell now or do you want to wait?
We've already touched on it. We might as well continue.
Do you think she's dead?
In the episode, I thought so. Then the actress seemed to slip up on After Trek, and that makes me think not dead.
I couldn't have said that better myself, because was exactly how I read it, that I thought she died. But when I heard Jane Brooke talk on After Trek, it seemed to me that she hadn't died. So I thought maybe it was a 90% chance that she died, but then the way, you know, it wasn't just her though. It was the way that they, you know, they talked about her character. They, you know, they would normally say, like they did with Georgiou when she was on there, you know, they would have said, oh, you died, you know, how does it feel that you've died? They didn't do that with her. Mm-hmm. same thing with Landry when Rika Sharma was on there on Skype, I guess. You know, they made it pretty obvious that she had died. They did not do that with Admiral Cornwell. So I think she's alive, both by what she said and the things that were said on the show. So
the dialogue before the final blows were landed in the fight, when Laurel and Cornwell both said, you know, you're not what I expected, I thought that was kind of a sign of mutual respect. And it was an unspoken agreement to that they were both now going to fight for real, because they both realized that there was no more there was no more play fighting to be done in front of Cole. Now, Laurel had to save her own skin by killing Cornwell, and Cornwell knew that. So Cornwell was going to fight to the death as well. And she just simply lost the fight. But yeah, then dragging her into a very unprotected room of corpses, that's a convenient place to hide a not really dead body. And then, like I said, I'm sorry, I forget the actress's name who played Cornwell.
Jane Brooke. Something.
Jane Brooke. Yeah. She started saying things in the wrong verb tense for a past tense character. So
exactly. Exactly. Oops. So, you know, I don't know if she survives the season, but it certainly seems that she has, she will survive. We'll see her again, probably next episode.
I really hope so. I like that character a lot.
I do too. She is one of the better admirals that we've seen in Starfleet, I think. Mm-hmm. Not just, well, it's for the way she plays it, the way that she's a well drawn out character. Like, she's three dimensional. She's not one of these badmirals like Admiral Pressman. Remember him from was it the Pegasus?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was yeah, the admirals always have some sort of hidden agenda, it seems.
Yeah. So anyway, I do hope that she's not gone, that we'll see her again. And, you know, I really want to see where this goes. I think the next episode is going to be good. In fact, you probably heard, if you watched After Trek, what Ted Sullivan, one of the writers on the show. By the way, I'm going to say this now, since I brought up Ted Sullivan, one of the writers on the show was on After Trek, and they're going to have two writers on the show next week. This is one thing that I absolutely love that they do on After Trek versus what they do on Talking Dead, which of course I do that podcast covering that show. They almost, other than the showrunners and maybe Mark, or not Mark, sorry, Robert Kirkman. I know a Mark Kirkman. That's why I said Mark Kirkman at the start. Anyway, Robert Kirkman, who's the creator. They never have the writers of the episodes on that show. And that's the writers are always the ones that I'm interested in. So the only like that's one big plus that I have to this after show versus Talking Dead, which is kind of funny because they're, like I say, they're owned by, is it Embassy Row, I believe.
Yeah.
And they run both Talking Dead and this show. So, same executive producer. So I wish that they would bring on the writers of that show on that show.
Yeah. That's a great touch because otherwise, like on Talking Dead, you either have the show creator who doesn't have specific insight to every episode, or you have the actors who are interpreting what was written. If you really want to get down to the meat of the story and talk about what happened, you need the writer.
Yeah.
It's, and especially in this case, like you said, the writer of this episode was on Voyager and right. responsible for continuity and things like that. So, you know, when it was mentioned that was no problem whatsoever for her, it's no wonder.
Well, she wasn't on the Voyager staff. She was a writer of Voyager novels.
Oh, okay. So okay. even more important then, because you can really obsess over the printed page way more than a 45-minute TV episode.
Well, and supposedly her Voyager novels have been some of the best Star Trek novels ever written, from what I've heard. Makes me definitely want to look into them. So I might read one over the hiatus or two if I can find them on Audible. All right. So, okay. So the crew, her crew, dead and dismembered and obviously not part of the sarcophagus, you know, what the Black Fleet, they called them, right?
Yeah.
So why do you think, Cole did that? And, I'm guessing these are the ones that like took his food and, you know, pledged allegiance to him because they got fed while Vok and, Laurel were on the, Shenzhou.
Yeah. Something I just thought of. Now, originally I just thought it was a power play on Cole's part to show that Laurel really had no power. But do you think the deceit he was referring to was her getting Vok safely away?
I don't know. I don't know if it was that or
like that. like her entire crew was killed while she was dealing with Cornwell.
Yeah, might be, or that he got wind of it. I don't know.
Otherwise, the only other deceit would have been that he knew that she was colluding with Cornwell.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. And it seemed like he went to a lot of trouble there. You know, he got her to put the face paint on and then, you know, turned it around on her.
Yeah, that was some interesting theatrics there. If you're going to... here's another question. What do you think he was going to do with her? Was he having her hauled away to be killed as well?
I don't know. I don't know.
So many questions left for the next episode.
And this is why I wonder if they took out some of this episode and tacked it on the next episode. You know, I really want to know that. I really do.
You know, the more we talk about this, the more I feel I should downgrade my my review rating.
And I feel like maybe I should upgrade it slightly because there are a lot of questions that are good questions that make me like, I guess the 7 really came out of me strongly objecting to the length of the episode, but there are a lot of questions there that I don't think would have been answered through a few extra minutes. So, you know, maybe I'm going to raise it to 7.25. I don't think I'm going to go any higher than that, but I'll give it a 7.25.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to bring mine down by half a point, actually, because there are so many questions and things that should have been dealt with better. So even though I like what was there, I'm becoming more annoyed at what was not there.
This happens a lot. I know, I don't know if we've done it much, but I know on my other podcasts, a lot of times, you know, my other co-host will bring me down or I will bring them up. So it's funny how this is working out. The best thing I think about Mark's voicemails is we just got probably 20 minutes of content out of him, out of a 5-minute voicemail. Right. So that's, I tell you, Mark, you do an amazing job with those voicemails. And I already gave you a showcase, but I'll give you this. Because you do a damn good job and you make this podcast better with your voicemails. So thanks again for all you do. This bud's for you. All right. Should we go to Fred's voicemail now?
Sure.
All right. Here it is. Oh, and Fred said in the voicemail that there was a gap in it. Well, I took care of it, Fred. And in fact, I was able to shorten it a little bit. I didn't take any of the content out, but I used a little special sauce that we do to make the gaps a little shorter. So I fixed it up for you, and I actually made it a little bit louder, so it should be good. Here we go.
Hello, Brian and Adam, and all listeners to the Star Trek Discovery podcast. This is Fred from the Netherlands with some feedback on episode 8. Just on the edge of tomorrow, I mean, just 8 minutes before the deadline, I give you my feedback. I did watch it twice, so I can say a little more than last time. I liked the episode, although I still give it a 7. It's a bit dull, like all other episodes I gave feedback for. It's still a 7. And it's 7 landing party equipment failing earplugs. And this refers to the fact that Saru was having problems and being tortured by the Parvo's music. What is this landing party equipment? There should be standard something like that in it. I have some no's and some yeses. Well, one of the yeses is surely the Gagarin fight scene. CGI was very, very nice. And that's actually also one of my no's, because if you look, for instance, to this towering crystal structure with trees and crystals, it's a lot of, let's say, fanciness difference between the fight scene with the Gagarin and then this structure. I had the same feeling with the Gormagander 2 episodes ago. So I think this Star Trek series has some very nice CGI and very nice sceneries and takes. And on the other hand, it's sometimes just not so good. And I don't know if they do it on purpose or they lack money or whatever, or they want to give a combination of the old 60s feeling in combination with modern Star Trek. I don't know if it's on purpose. It looks like Gormal didn't survive the fight with Lorel. I hope she's alive, but it looks quite dead, so we probably won't see her anymore, which is a pity. But it's a part of the story, so it's not a real no. What is a no is the scene between Tyler and Burnham. The scene about the lake house and the kiss, and it's a strange scene in the middle of the episode, and it has a kind of pause in the episode, and it's a kind of misplaced, I think. The last scene where Burnham is saying that they are the only defense for the Parvos, between the Klingons and the Parvos. I don't know what kind of power these Parvos have. Burnham says, we have to fight. Well, I really wonder if that's true, and whether these Pavos have not more power than Michael thinks. Okay, that was all for this time. Till next time, greetings, Adam and Brian, and perhaps a little bit for Mark. Till next time, all listeners of the Star Trek Discovery Podcast. Bye-bye.
Well, thanks, Fred from the Netherlands. One thing I wanted to mention that you did was the towering crystal structure, as you called it. I was not impressed with this either. What about you, Adam?
Yeah, it definitely showed that this was a one episode only effect.
Yeah, like, you know, the space battles seem to be incredible, and I just wasn't really impressed with the thing. It's like, oh, it's a tree? It's a tree. Oh, okay. It's a tree with crystals on it. That looks kind of weird. That was my reaction to it.
Yeah, I wasn't sure the first time we saw it on screen if this was going to be some sort of like Jack and the Beanstalk allegory or something. I honestly thought someone was going to start climbing the thing at some point.
Yeah. It's funny you say that. I would definitely agree. Okay. So he mentioned something that you mentioned, which was, he said, the Burnham Ash scenes, he specifically said they seemed to be misplaced. And yeah, it was in the editing, you know, like I said, someone went kind of crazy and edited the crap out of the episode. And it seemed like they left a bunch of this stuff in where they maybe shouldn't have. What do you think?
Yeah, I would agree with that. You're on an away mission, duty calls. Keep it in your pants, so to speak.
I would have much preferred to see more of Saru and what he was going through than to see, you know, them kissy face. It just, to me, it just didn't seem appropriate and didn't seem like the best thing that was going on. So
what did you think about the dialogue, though, the way they repurposed the needs of the many, needs of the few and all that?
Fan service. That's about what I thought of it as. Just, you know, it was fan service, not much more.
Yeah, I thought they did a good job, at least, of dicing it up a little bit. So it sounded somewhat organic.
Yeah.
Once you get the first sentence out, the rest of it did kind of play off of it well. But yeah, obviously that they wouldn't have invented that line for this episode. They were clearly pulling on the past.
Yeah, they definitely were pulling on the past. And, you know, probably something that Sarek taught them both.
And that's the only reason I didn't absolutely roll my eyes at it, was because I could believe that Sarek did actually tell her that.
Yeah, obviously that's, I guess, where having that relationship works, you know, but, what else we got here? Okay. So we know that the, Organians, they are involved in the treaty that ends the Klingon War. So it makes me wonder if the Pavans are actually the Organians. if that turns out to be the same species. I mean, possible. But I don't know if that's what it's going to be.
Yeah, if they're already introducing that with six episodes left to go. I'm sorry, seven, actually, because we've still got next week. That'd be really interesting if halfway through the season they introduce the race that's going to actually end the conflict for everybody. The question I had, once you pointed it out, was do you think the Klingons really serve to gain anything from the planet? Given that all that the Federation was there for was to try to gain hold of the technology that might help them detect cloaked vessels.
I don't know if they gain anything by it, but they certainly would gain by destroying it if the planet can help detect. And okay, since we bring it in here, this is also something that I had docked the episode four, and this is the tech. Okay, so this was kind of hand waved over that somehow this planet would, you know, provide something like sonar and detect Klingon vessels. How exactly would that work? Exactly. It was almost like this could have used some good old, you know, Next Generation / Voyager techno babble, or as I hear it called a lot now, Trekno babble, which I hate that term. You know, I would have liked to have heard a little bit more of, you know, oh, well, you know, the Verderon particles will cause a, you know, subspace wave to yada, 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 detect the Klingon vessels.
Brian, you rookie. It's always tachyons.
Tachyons. You're right. Well, I have heard tachyons. I've heard decyons. I've heard, what's another one that they like? They used to like.
Well, you said Verderons.
Yeah. Yeah. But yes, tachyons are very important in the.
Oh, chronoton. If you want to do time travel, it's chronoton.
Yes. Yeah. Chronoton. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. They're calling it sonar, which refers to sound, which refers to vibrations, which does not exist in the vacuum of space. So I'm not exactly sure how that analogy is valid, but okay. That's when I just went with it. And even if the planet can detect cloaked vessels because of the antenna, what are they going to do? Are they going to rip the antenna off the planet and bolt it onto the Discovery?
I think they were just planning on using the antenna on the planet, but I mean, what would stop the Klingons or anybody else for that matter coming around destroying that antenna? I mean,
and what's the range on this antenna? Is it going to detect every Klingon vessel in the entire galaxy?
It seems hardly likely, doesn't it? I mean,
yeah. Yeah. So that was just one of those premise points that I just glossed over.
Plus, you know, there's the whole thing of like, you know, thousands of light years, you know, like sound, if it's sound, that doesn't go anywhere near thousands of light years in speed, you know?
Oh, details,
details, details. Yes. One should not try to, dissect too much.
Yeah, we are trying to inject realism into a show that's based around a spaceship that jumps from point to point in the galaxy using spores.
I will say this. I love the show. Okay. So if anybody's going to accuse me because I'm like a little bit negative this week, I love the show. And I'm doing this out of, well, it's like I said in the very first episode, you know, what motivated me to try to, you know, get in there and to sell a story to them. You know, I watched an episode that I distinctly didn't like and thought I could write a better one. And, you know, part of me still wants to do that someday, even though I'm kind of getting up there in years. It's less likely now, but I still think I could write good Star Trek. You know, I do. And, as I said, I don't think that what Kirsten Beyer wrote in this episode was bad. I think it was actually a good script. It just seemed like parts were missing, like they had been edited out. And I think that they were there at some point and somehow got taken out for either they were never shot, they were too expensive, they ran out of time. You know, they for whatever reason, cut them and put them in the next episode, or they just cut them out entirely. I don't know. These are questions that I would love to know, though. And if I ever get to interview people that are in, you know, the know, I would ask them those questions. So
these seem like the sort of things that would come out in behind the scenes interviews on a season DVD set, or maybe even at like a Comic-Con or something after the show, you know, finishes its run.
Right.
I don't think these are the kind of things you're going to find out while the show's still on the air.
You probably won't. You probably won't. All right. Shall we move on to Stefan?
Certainly. I'll go ahead and take this one here. He said, so the Klingon ship is now officially the ship of death. It didn't have a name in the first episode. Vok is still gone. Or is he?
Oh, that's the wrong one. Shoot.
There we go.
That button is one above the rim shot button. Oh, well.
Okay. All right. Hold on. I'm going to set a marker on that. Okay. Sorry, I'm working on one monitor tonight, so I can't be in Audition and in the Google Doc at the same time. All right. Bad news for humans that all Klingon ships end up having cloaking tech. That must have been the main purpose of the opening battle, to show that. R.I.P. Starship Gagarin. I really like that little comment Stamets made to Tilly calling her captain, because that shows that he exists in another level outside the timeline in his mind. It also links to episode 2 when Tilly and Michael meet for the first time and she reveals that she will become a captain one day. So next week, Battle of Pavo. In one corner, Discovery. In the other, the Ship of Death.
I figured that was more appropriate for the Ship of Death.
Very nice. Very nice.
All right. Okay, so I got to ask this question since Stefan brings it up about the cloaking devices. Okay, it seems like all of the ships with allegiance to Cole or House of Kor are getting the cloaking tech from this Ship of Death. Anyway, so this brings up the question. The Klingons were not supposed to have cloaking devices at this time, right?
I need to know my Trek history better to corroborate that, unfortunately. Did they have it in the original series?
They, I thought, got it from the Romulans. Okay, so at the start of the original series, they did not have the cloaking devices, and they got the cloaking tech from the Romulans, I think, in the third season, if I'm not mistaken. So, and then, of course, we see them in the movies with the cloaking devices. But
yes, here, I've got it from StarTrek.com right here. I didn't even have to go to the webpage. I just Googled Klingon cloaking device, and here's the summary on Google's search results. Similar to the Romulan cloaking device, the Klingons received this technology from the Romulans circa 2268.
Right.
When the civilizations shared a political alliance.
12 years from this point, since they're supposedly in 2256, or maybe, excuse me, now early 2257. So it's too early for them to get a Klingon or a cloaking device. I hope that this is explained pretty soon, because otherwise they have, I hate to say it, but gone against canon. Okay, I'm going to retire that sound effect for the rest of the episode.
I think it would have gone with a what on that one, actually.
What?
Yeah. But again, they're doing such a good job when they want to of paying attention to continuity in canon that anytime they go against it, at this point, I'm assuming that there's a deliberate story reason for it.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, if there's not, then I'll riot at the end of the season.
But the Klingons are not supposed to have cloaking devices right now. The fact that they do, it's impossible.
That's not true. That's impossible.
I played that just for you, man.
Thank you.
All right. Shall we move on to Rick's feedback?
Sure. What did Rick have to say?
Well, Rick from Cleveland. And like I said, second episode in a row, we got some feedback from someone from Cleveland who identified themselves as being someone from Cleveland. And Brian and Adam from Cleveland say thank you. Anyway, the Pavans are an interesting addition, he says. According to canon, the Klingon War ends with the Organian Peace Treaty. The Pavans are very similar to what we know of the Organians. Okay, well, maybe I must have absorbed some of Rick's feedback in what I was saying earlier. When Saru gives Tyler the green crystal and discovered his deception, I half expected that it was a larger deception than just Burnham's trip to the tower. At this point, after seeing Laurel's interactions with Cornwell, I wonder just what Vok's endgame would be if he is masquerading as Tyler. Perhaps looking to tip the power away from House Kor is his new motivation. But then, the further we get with Tyler, the more I question whether he is Vok. I suppose that is what the writers intend. I love the scenes with Tilly and Stamets. I do hope that somehow we get to see Captain Tilly, and that was not just confusion on Stamets' part. Perhaps some flash to the future he experiences in Spore World. And then he ends with, thanks for the podcast. Love it. Well, thank you, Rick from Cleveland. And I have to say, I'm right there with you. I wonder about Vok and Tyler. Like, it's, I'm so of two minds at this point. I can totally see it. And, but then again, it's like everything he does makes me think it, he isn't Vok. But then we see what, you know, the way that Laurel's acting in this episode, very interested that Cornwell came from the Discovery. And asking those, you know, questions about, like, you know, death penalty and, you know, all of that just makes me wonder. Really makes me wonder. I could see it. I could honestly see him being Vok, but I could see where he wouldn't be Vok. But if he's not Vok, I don't know where she's coming from and what her end game is. Much less Vok's endgame. And if he's not Vok, where is Vok and what is Vok doing? She said that, what'd she say, that he had been carried away or something? That I don't think that's what she said, but something taken away, or I can't remember exactly the words that she used, but.
Yeah, we're led to believe, or at least we're led to believe, that everyone thinks Vok is dead. And I've personally seen very little in the show to support the whole, Tyler is Vok theory. I think it's more the IMDb scandal with the actor's page and credits and whatnot. I think it's the behind the scenes stuff that's really fueling this.
I think so too. I mean, and of course I've found enough, on my own to lead to it. But if, from a story perspective, other than Laurel, and timing, you know, issues between Tyler and, you know, the whole 7 months with her being on the sarcophagus ship for 6 of those months, you know, somehow the math doesn't work, but that could be explained lots of different ways. Like, he could have been a POW on the sarcophagus ship. So anything is really possible, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll just have to wait and see on that one, I think. I think it feels like so many of these mysteries and supposed canon flubs and things, it's just designed to set up as many plot threads as needed to pull on later. So some might be abandoned, some might be wrapped up, and some might just be straightforward.
Yep. Do you have anything else that you want to talk about Rick's feedback, or should we move on to our own little points?
No, let's keep this rolling here.
All right. So what do you have that you want to start with?
Well, most of my points have been discussed in voicemail, but I did want to I did want to get your take on Burnham, if we can revisit that a little bit, because this is the first episode where I really realized that the parts of the episode I like the least are the parts involving our supposed main character. Do you feel like the focus is too much on her?
Too much on her.
Like, is her character compelling enough to justify all the characterization and screen time that we're getting with her?
I don't know. I think at first it was, but you know, like most Star Trek shows and, you know, most shows like this, it becomes an ensemble show. So yeah, I mean, she gets a lot of screen time and, you know, like we were saying, her character isn't as dynamic as that lead character should be, I think. So I reluctantly say no, but you know, it's like I'm kind of torn because, like I say, I think she's doing a great job. You know, I have no complaints about her acting. The complaints that I have more have to do with her character, not even so much the writing of her character, but just her character traits in general, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wouldn't say things have been easy for her. Obviously she had one heck of a come down, you know, from the first two episodes to how she ended up on Discovery. But it seems like every time she's presented with a new situation, she always comes out on top and always has the information that no one else has. It's just, it'd be nice if maybe someone else could have some of her abilities at times.
Yeah.
You know, her first assignment on Discovery was troubleshooting engineering equations for the spore drive. And then all of a sudden it switches over to biology and she knows all about microbiology. And then in this episode, she knows all about Saru's physiology and the history of his species. And she can fight hand to hand and she gets the attention of the dashing new security chief. And how much more can things fall in her favor at this point?
Yeah. And, you know, she's the first contact specialist as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I do see your point. It's like she's the prodigy who has somehow gone awry. You know, I think I don't know, maybe I'll have a better answer next time, but you know, I just think that making her so Klingon like, or the Klingon like, there I did it again, there's an errata,
incorrect.
Making her more Vulcan-like, I don't think it does great things for her character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just it makes it wooden, makes her character kind of wooden.
Yeah, and they've tried this with other characters before, the whole social outcast or the awkwardness where they don't understand humanity. We had it with Spock, we had it with Data. And I think it was pulled off to much better effect because they typically would behave incorrectly in a situation. And it would at least lead to some passive comedy, if not a good character arc of them trying to understand and define whatever that human condition is that they had missed in that circumstance. And instead in hers, she's just, it's more like the awkward nerd in high school than an actual fish out of water scenario.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I do want to see where it goes, and I am really curious where things are going to land at the end of the season, and for that matter, the other thing that I didn't mention in the news was that, you know, season two may not air until 2019, so we may have a big break in between. So, you know, we don't know. May air in January 2019 for that matter, but still going to be after that, the last six might be a bit of a break.
Yeah. That's one of the unfortunate things of this new streaming model is a lot of series go through that where they produce one season to see what the audience reaction is. and then don't begin any production on the second season until it's so late that you get this huge lag between seasons.
Yeah, and like Game of Thrones is going through, you know, a similar thing now. Like, it was more than a year wait, you know, for season 7, and it sounds like it might be a year and a half or even more for the last season of it. So
fans will wait, though.
Oh yeah,
they are patient. Yeah. Now the one thing you had as a final point here, you said, so what's going on with Stamets now? And what do you think about that? Because we've seen him as his goofy, friendly self, and now he kind of reverted back to his cranky original personality. So what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, the one theory that I've seen is that he's interacting with, or maybe even the cause or the spores of the cause of the mirror universe. And you know, that maybe this is like the anti, Stamets, but I don't know. It seems funny that one could be that. I don't know. I don't have an answer, but, I was kind of surprised to see him, you know, be Mr. Snippy, again. I thought that was over, but, you know, maybe he was just a little cranky, getting tired, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I thought I had it figured out as well. And seeing cranky Stamets back makes me question everything again. But then he came down a little bit, you know, when Tilly actually sat him down and forced him to talk, which I thought was a really nice touch. The fact that, you know, the little cadet is standing up to the chief engineer and making him have a discussion with her. But yeah, he leveled off and he actually said what was bothering him and had a pretty decent rationale for it. So what I thought was originally just a personality quirk of him being a jerk, occasionally has rationale behind it.
And it makes me wonder too, not specifically about him, but I'm very, very curious at this point. He's Dr. Culber is very prominent when it comes to the medical staff. So where is the CMO? And, you know, did we see him last week? Was that the guy that was in the shuttle bay with the Gormagander? Or was that, you know, have we yet to see him? I'm still wondering what the deal is, because it's like every time that there's something medical, he ends up being the doctor. We never see the other, you know, supposedly head doctor.
Yeah, I was wondering that myself. I'm choosing to believe the one we saw last week is the CMO, just so the guy gets some screen time.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know. That guy must be very busy, because apparently all the work goes to the underlings.
Yeah. Looks like most of my points have been brought up already as well. Do you have anything else?
No, I think our audience members picked up on the same beats we did this week.
And again, for the, I guess, third or fourth week in a row, I did not find a 47. So, and I never got confirmation about the 53 deaths of Lorca, whether or not we didn't see 47 of them. I didn't go back and do the math, so that is not confirmed. But that's it for this week. So to submit your feedback to us, connect with us, best, there are several ways. Go to goldenspiralmedia.com/feedback, and that's how we typically get our audio feedback, but we get text that way as well. And on that page is a SpeakPipe widget that you can use to get your feedback to us as well. There's also a voicemail line. It's at 304-837-2278. You can send us email. That's at StarTrekGSM@gmail.com. Or the best way for most people to give feedback to us is through our Facebook group, which if you want to join, just say join, and I ask a question of what's your favorite Star Trek, and you answer, and one of us lets you in. So that's at facebook.com/groups/Star Trek Discovery Podcast. Nice and easy to remember. Our Twitter is Star Trek GSM, just like our Gmail is. And the deadline for submitting feedback to us is on Monday at 6 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Central. And for those of you that didn't just go through the fallback, we just went an hour behind because of the daylight savings time ending. We're now on what they call standard time. So you have an extra hour, I think, to get us feedback. To support us, one of the best ways to do it is to subscribe to us in your favorite podcast app. Of course, Apple rates us depending on subscriptions, so that is very helpful. And of course, also helpful are ratings and reviews. And we didn't get any more reviews, but we did get another 5-star rating this week, so in the US. So thank you very much. That helps. Because there are a ton of Star Trek Discovery podcasts. I remember when I first bought the domain, there was only one. So,
yeah, you got on it early, but they proliferated fast.
Yeah. Anyway, so as we're going to work out our Patreon, I've got some ideas on that, Adam. So we'll talk about that soon. But we will do a Patreon. We'll have it ready for the next half of the season. And there are other ways to support us and the network. Go to goldenspiralmedia.com/support. Why don't you read the next episode?
Sure. The next episode, which will wrap up the first half of season one, is called Into the Forest I Go, written by Bo Yeon Kim and Erica Lippold, who will be guests on After Trek next week. We don't have information on the director or any episode synopsis yet, but obviously we can expect that it's going to be the Discovery and the sarcophagus ship squaring off over Pavo, and with the fate of the planet literally hanging in the balance. The quick synopsis that they said, I believe this was from After Trek. Is that right, Brian?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, they said it is balance of terror good, which is the high watermark of any Star Trek episode. So we'll see if it can measure up there. And also joining on After Trek next week is going to be Sonequa Martin-Green, Michael Burnham herself, and Mary Wiseman as well. So should have some good guests to check out on the after show next week.
Yeah, and supposedly that was Ted Sullivan that called it balance of terror good, and was just saying how good these two young writers are that wrote the episode. But if it's half as good as he said it's going to be, we're in for a heck of an episode. So that's it for this week. So I'm Brian.
And I'm Adam.
Peace and long life.
And live long and prosper.